So Michael Jordan is arguably the greatest basketball player in history, 14-time All-Star, 6 championships, multiple MVPs. And on the one hand, that sounds really impressive, but let me reframe it. He's the greatest player of a game where you throw a ball at a basket. It doesn't just sound as impressive. At age 50, 10 years after his retirement, he said, "I would give up everything now to go back and play the game of basketball." And at his Hall of Fame induction speech 2 years ago, he essentially rebuked his enemies and talked about himself. And then he brought up his 3 children who were present. He had divorced his wife. And he told them at his Hall of Fame speech, he said, "I feel sorry for you because of the tall shadow you have to live with." And then during the same ceremony, David Robinson, who's a believer, was also being inducted. He mostly thanked the people in his life who'd helped him along the way. And then he looked at his 3 children and encouraged them and cast vision for him. Jordan's going to be the first, probably, the athlete to be worth $1 billion. And he has a security team that travels with him. And when they travel, his code name is Yahweh that they've given him. He didn't give it to himself. But Yahweh is a Hebrew word for God. It's the unspoken name of God. And he confessed, as he was talking to a ESPN writer, he said that my ego is so big now, I expect certain things. And he struggles, by his own admission, to find peace and his place apart from basketball. But the truth is, basketball never did give him peace. It was an imitation of the real thing. Basketball was a game invented by a PE teacher in New England who was given 14 days to develop an indoor game that wouldn't take up too much space, that would keep a rowdy class full of track athletes distracted during the New England winter. So he nailed peach basket to a wall, basketball. So there's nothing wrong with making a living in the world of sports entertainment, but to believe that playing a game makes you valuable or can give you peace is a recipe for disaster. And I know his security team is being facetious when they call him Yahweh, but he is a 52-year-old former athlete who is going to die someday. And we all struggle with creating gods to worship or thinking of ourselves as gods to be worshiped. And either of those approaches will strip a soul bare. So it's interesting that when human beings think of themselves as God, we create and believe in a certain lifestyle, a certain way of looking at them. And then when God actually became a man, he didn't live or die like men believe a God would live and die like. So we're in Mark chapter 14. I'm going to start in verse 26. And like as I said last week, a third of the book of Mark is the last week of the Lord's life. The gospel is about the gospel, the death of Christ, the resurrection of Christ. When they sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. This is right after the Lord's Supper, the Passover. "You will all fall away," Jesus told them, "for it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. But after I have risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee." Peter declared, "Even if all fall away, I will not." "I tell you the truth," Jesus declared, answered, "today, yes, tonight, before the rooster crows twice, you yourself will disown me 3 times." But Peter insisted emphatically, "Even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you." And all the others said the same. They went to a place called Gethsemane, and Jesus said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." He took Peter, James, and John with him, and he began to be deeply distressed and troubled. "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch." Going a little further, he fell to the ground and prayed that if possible, the hour might pass from him. "Abba, Father," he said, "everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will." Then he returned to his disciples and found them sleeping. Simon, he said to Peter, "Are you asleep? Could you not keep watch for 1 hour? Watch and pray so you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the body is weak." Once more he went out and prayed the same thing. When he came back, he found them sleeping because their eyes were heavy. They didn't know what to say to him. Returning the third time, he said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Enough. The hour has come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let's go. Here comes my betrayer." Then in verse 50, everyone deserted him and fled. Some years ago, my dad went through a terrible, challenging time in his life. He was and is a strong man, a man of sacrificial love and great faith. But during this time, some of his closest friends had turned on him, and they had unjustly implicated him in their own misdeeds. And so it was a time of great distress for him and for all of us. And I remember one day, standing outside, we were standing beside his mailbox. at the curb, and the weight of grief was crushing him. And we hugged, and I said I was there for him, and then I got in my car, and I remember driving away weeping because the strongest person in my life was not strong on that day. So think about your own life when you've experienced someone you relied on being struck with grief or illness. Maybe a key leader in your life lost their way. And you can then just begin to imagine the effect on the disciples of the sudden change that came over Jesus in Gethsemane. He's been in control. He's been strong. He's been standing up to opposition, storms, demons, disease, death, taking authority over vast crowds in the temple. He always had the right words and the right action. And now here he is telling them, you're all going to fall apart. You're all going to fail me. Not a whole lot of comfort and encouragement, not a compelling vision to cast. So who is this guy? Doesn't seem like the same man. This is a frightening narrative, and Jesus is in horror. His best friends are drowsy. They're unprepared for what's coming. This is God's plan, and on the eve of D-Day, things don't look good for this distressed leader or his listless followers. When the renowned philosopher Socrates went to death, was forced to drink poison, he was in control through the process. Historically, the history of his life says his followers were distraught. They were in tears, and he was comforting them, teaching them right up to the end. You know, but the Gospels are not your typical hero story. There is certainly no fabrication here. They're not embellished to make the main characters look good. They just tell us what happened. And here in the Gospel of Mark, the Lord is overcome with horror. He's praying for another way. And he's back in one of his favorite spots. He's in a garden near the Mount of Olives, and he had been there before more than once. He spent more than one night there. On this night, he took his three closest friends with him, allowing them to see that he was deeply distressed and troubled, which is interesting because often we would want to hide that from the closest people to us. But he brought them in, let them watch it. And deeply distressed and troubled, they're not redundant words. Sometimes in the Greek, words that are put together that make a separate phrase. And so the phrase together, the words together, means powerful sense of bewilderment, uncertainty, anxiety. And so these things in themselves are not sin, either in Jesus or in us. But it's breathtaking to think of Jesus experiencing these things. In his distress, he prayed to Abba, which is the Aramaic word for Father. And it's a word that always connotated intimate affection and devotion. But the Jews would never use this word to address God because they thought it was disrespectful. But Jesus didn't hesitate to use it. And he says, I know that anything is possible for God. And yet he prays, if possible, the cup could be taken. And the cup he was talking about is a metaphor, a common Old Testament metaphor for God's wrath. If you read the Old Testament prophets, they would talk about the cup of God's wrath being poured out. And it's judgment on human sin. So he's asking, if possible, he could escape having to drink of this cup of God's wrath. And God can do anything that can be done. He can make the universe from nothing with a spoken word. There's no logical contradiction in that. But he cannot redeem without a redeemer. There's no other way. And so he prayed to Abba that if possible, the cup would pass from him. Is there another way? And the answer he received was no. This cup is not going to be removed. He's going to drink judgment, our judgment for our sins. And so he submitted his will to his Father's. Now think about this on a personal level. If Jesus received this answer to his own faith-filled, heartfelt prayer, why are we surprised when we sometimes receive the same answer? That is no. And this whole narrative refutes two things. One, the belief that our goal is to become people who can have the faith that we would calmly and without emotion accept the sometimes terrifying will of God for our lives. We're full of emotion. We're full of passion and longing. It's how God made us. We're full of dread. Of course, we should take all of this to God, but Jesus was filled with dread and dismay. There was no detached, no robotic surrender here. His death was called the Passion of the Christ for good reason. It was full-bore emotion, no mindless resignation. There are world religions like Buddhism where the objective to become super spiritual is to get to the place where you're passionless and you're detached about suffering, your own and others. But that's not the gospel. He also refutes the belief here that if we have real faith, we'll escape real suffering. And Jesus asked if the cup could be taken from him, and God said no. And a no to our prayers doesn't indicate a lack of concern in God's heart. It indicates a different purpose in the mind of God. And so while Jesus is struggling in his soul, his best friends are struggling to stay awake. And he comes out of this agonizing time of prayer three times. He comes out. He says to his friends, wake up, let's go. And he's now composed. He's asked for another way. There isn't another way, so he's yielded to God. And so he's living out Psalms once again. He was disoriented, took his pain to God. There he was reoriented. Now he's surrendered and resolved. And his sleepy friends, who didn't accept his challenge to watch and pray so you won't fall into temptation, were not ready. While he was preparing for what was to come, they were sleepy. And so they were unprepared. And so what we see here is the Lord is not serenely sailing through his trials, unconcerned with the mundane world around him. He is almost dead with distress. And I'll tell you that it's inconceivable that the early church could or would have made up a story like this. This is not how the myth of the time, the fables of the time went. The heroes rose above this stuff. So that's compelling, another compelling fact of the reality and truth of the gospel narrative. So we're going to focus on three verses and three words for application. The verses are 34, 5, and 6. And I'll give you the words. My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch. Going a little further, he fell to the ground and prayed that if possible, the hour might pass from him. Abba, Father, everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me. Yet not what I will, but what you will. So the first word is soul. You have one. You are more than the physical. You are not less than the physical or other than the physical. You are both and. You are physical and spiritual. You are temporal and you are eternal. And when Jesus said that his soul was overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death, he could see what lied ahead, what was in front of him, separation from God. And nothing had caused him great distress, demons, disease, death, but this did. And the idea that he was going to experience separation from God the Father burdened his soul to the point of death. I don't understand it. I do, however, know that it's real. A poet once wrote, and I'll just give one line from a poem, had Mary been filled with reason, there would have been no room for a child. And this is not saying that our experience of God is irrational, but that it's above the full reach of reason. People tend to think that it's reasonable to disbelieve what we cannot fully comprehend, but that, in fact, is an irrational approach to the world, because it's reasonable to believe that reality is much more than our reason can fully comprehend. Certainly that's true when it comes to God becoming man in the incarnation. So all this happened just like Mark said it did. The Lord did the things that Mark said he did. His soul suffered like Mark said he did. But why was it so painful for him? Because the Lord experienced a truly full soul. He lived an intimate relationship with God the Father. He lived completely in line with his design as he became a man. And so what he contemplated was separation from his Father, the source of all fullness. And he was going to, Philippians said, choose to empty himself. And he's showing us here the despair of an empty soul. Mike Jordan was driven by this inner need. Some say it is what made him great. The hunger drove him. But listening to him now and looking at his life now, the way his hunger has worked out has not made him happy or healthy. And he is said to have had a drive to make his own name great. Even today, it's said that he cares so much about what his critics say about him. And he's been out of the game for over a decade. And they said it's like a needle for a hungry vein. So without speculating on the condition of his soul, I'll simply say that Michael Jordan has a soul, and like every single soul, it was made for God and empty without him. And you can dump the world in there, and it won't even fill up any of that void that's there. Every sinful desire and action is a result of a misdirection of our souls, looking for a substitute for the reality of God and what he alone gives. And there are questions that drive human lives. Am I valuable? Am I loved? Am I safe? Am I in control? And at the root of most all interpersonal problems, at the root of all relational problems, are these basic questions. And these questions either drive us to God or they drive us to folly. Finding our life in God or creating gods and becoming gods. And our struggles are rooted in attempts at different levels to fill our soul apart from Christ. This is not just church talk. This is enormously practical. This is where you live externally and internally, this is where I live. Every single problem I've ever dealt with in my life or with people all goes back to this root of trying to find something in that will fill our souls apart from God. And Jesus suffered in his soul, and as he looked at what was in front of him, what he was suffering with was the reality that was coming. He was going to be separated from God, his Father. So suffering is the next word from these verses. Jesus asked to be excused from suffering. He was told, no, you're going to go through this. And our souls are not safe from suffering, but they are safe through it. And that sounds trite, but that is terrifying. I can be terrified by thoughts of what might happen to me and those I love. And there have been times in my life when my greatest fears have been confirmed. Probably true for you as well. And so one of the strategies I've developed, and it's a foolish strategy, I'm not advocating it, but I'll tell you up front, it's a foolish strategy, is I've become hardened to happiness and joy because I don't trust them. They can mock me because around the corner, they lead to loss. That's wrong thinking, but that's my reality at times. Some people live in constant fear of what might be, some just occasional fear, but for everyone, if the time is right or maybe the time is wrong, circumstances are just right, the thought and the reality of suffering is overwhelming. And when we suffer, there are some common questions that people have. Even people who didn't say they didn't believe in God will commonly have these questions to God. God, when will this stop? Will this stop? God, why me? God, where are you? God, are you good? Was I wrong about you all the time? God, how do I make sense out of life now that this has happened to me? I've heard these questions over and over. You know, Santa Claus is a myth. It's likely you already knew that, but I thought I would let you know he's a myth. And in Christmas lore, Santa is semi-omniscient. I mean, he knows the good deeds and bad deeds of everyone. He's semi-omnipresent at least one night a year. And he's semi-omnipotent. He can carry billions of toys in a single bag. And so Santa, I like Santa. I don't like Satan. And Santa's a myth, Satan's not. Santa is a myth that follows human logic. He gives what we deserve. So if you've been good, you get good. If you've been bad, you get bad. And the greatest question in human history related to the reality of God is the question of suffering. And here's a common thought process. Common human thought process. And we may believe different, but deep down inside, we revert to this when we suffer. If I've been good, however that's defined, I will get good. If I've been bad, I'll get bad. And you couple that with the fact that almost all humans lean towards thinking of themselves as good. And you say, well, Terry, I feel shame and guilt. That's true. Most humans feel shame and guilt, but a great number of psychological studies have shown most humans tend to, when they rank themselves on a comparative scale, rate themselves as good. So here you go. Deep down, I believe that if I'm good, and I believe that I'm good, and I believe that God rewards good with good, what's likely to happen when I suffer? Something's got to give. Either I'm going to say, I'm not good, I deserve this, or God is not good, or he's not who I thought he was. But my worldview hasn't proven adequate for the real world that I live in. And Scripture gives a number of answers for the question of, can God be there, can God be good, can God be powerful, and there still be suffering? But the most powerful answer is in this narrative. And here, Jesus, who is sinless, with faith to move mountains, says no sin problem, no lack of faith, asks for a reprieve from suffering, is told no. I know we're not Jesus, he's the Savior, but Scriptures are clear that we're to do two things in relation to his life. We are to look to him for salvation, we're also to look for him for example, both. So suffering sometimes, oftentimes, fits into the larger purposes of God. And the premise that God is similar to Santa, we're good as we define it right now, follows good as we see ourselves right now, is a false premise. And it makes us vulnerable to wrong thinking and wrong living. It sets us up for failure. It makes us non-resilient. And that thinking, if it embeds in our brain, it's not biblical thinking. It's not how the world really is. It doesn't make us resilient. I'm relieved and encouraged when I watch Jesus struggling to come to grips with God's purposes. He's not nonchalant. He's not strolling through the garden making bold claims of conquering faith. He's suffering in his soul. And the Word says that he was tempted in every way just as we are, yet without sin. So what he's experiencing there is he's suffering like we do, but there's no sin in that. And I'm encouraged by that because I've had obviously nothing at all like what he experienced and nothing like many of you have experienced. But I have had a time when I felt my soul was so burdened. There was so much anxiety. I thought it would stop my heart. I'm not talking metaphorically. I thought the anxiety was going to make my physical heart stop beating. And on the worst day, a friend spent the afternoon driving me around, and he was in complete silence, but he was vigilant. He was praying. He was alert to my needs. And Jesus, on his worst night, found his friends asleep. Third word is surrender. Yet not my will, but yours be done. And I've heard people say that if you pray to God to do something and you then add the caveat, if it's your will, it's a sign of a lack of faith. You should never add that caveat. My conclusion is, if Jesus prayed this way, I'm confident that it's sound thinking and sound theology. I think I'll just stick with it. And Jesus went very quickly from soul suffering to surrender. And it doesn't mean his soul stopped suffering, but it meant he was able to move forward into life that God had for him. And it's not likely he was able to move forward very quickly because he was the God-man. In other words, it was because he was so much not like us. But what we see here is he was much like us. Like Rodney said, there you can't polarize with Jesus. He was fully God and fully man. And here, as a man, he was practicing trusting God, but he had already been practicing that for many, many years. And so when he had his dark night, his spiritual and his physical reflexes were trained to trust. And it's taken me a long time to get to the place of where I could tell you, yeah, I trust God. But one time it took me 2 years where I could look in the mirror and I could say, I trust God. It took me 2 years of praying to know that it was true in my heart. Training to trust can be long. And it's going to be ongoing in our lives. But there's no area of our lives where we believe we could never practice and yet perform well when necessary. We don't think that's true at work or sports or music. But somehow we think that we cannot practice trusting God, train to trust God, and that when we really need to trust Him, that the reflexes will be there. It's important to note that Jesus was back in Gethsemane. This is not His first time here. He'd been here before. It's not His first time praying through the night. And during His darkest night, He was not a rookie at praying through the night. In fact, this is the very place He was used to being with God. And the reason He was able to move so quickly to trust is that for years He had trained Himself to trust. And training comes from a biblical word that we get the word discipline from. And we get another word, disciple, from. A disciple is a learner, a follower, someone who's training to trust. And maybe you're going through some rigorous training right now. And I would say, don't despair that it's taken a while to get from not my will but yours. I would just say, don't despair that it's taking you some time to get there, but understand that's where you want to get to. That is your soul's safe harbor. You want to get there. So I'll give you those three words again, those three important realities, and then we'll conclude. Your soul. You are more than what you see in the mirror. And what happens to your soul is of enormous importance. The Lord said, what good does it do for a man to gain the whole world and lose a soul? And I don't know the status of Mike Jordan's soul, but he has, as much as anyone, probably gained the world. And there's clear evidence that he's enormously unfulfilled from his own mouth. And the Lord was suffering in his soul at the thought of being apart from his Father. And this informs us very directly of our own souls. We were made for him. So whatever we think we're looking for, the reality is our souls are thirsty for God. And as we look to fix our problems, which is smart, as we look to diagnose our struggles, which is smart, make sure you're not just looking externally. It's not just what's in my bank account or my job or my spouse or lack of a spouse or my health. Look to your soul. Are you trying to substitute something for God there? If so, that's where you start. You're suffering. He's not Santa, he's God. And since your soul is so valuable, suffering is important to the development of your soul. He's not going to keep suffering from us. You say, well, then I don't want to fool with him. Well, you cannot fool with him, and not fooling him is not going to keep suffering from you. It's just going to keep you from him while you suffer. You see, if he loves us, he will use suffering to perfect us. Your surrender, the Lord didn't surrender out of resignation. Hebrews says it was for the joy set before him he endured the cross. He went through the dark night of the soul, and then he didn't come out with passionless resignation. He came out and had surrendered to God, and then for the joy set before him went to the cross. And we can become people, it's going to be a lifetime journey, we can become people who surrender because of the joy that is in surrender. And again, don't despair if you don't feel that. This is the path. There are no rails that you can put your engine on and take your hands off the wheel, but there is a path, and that's the path. Let's pray together. Talk to God, and then listen to God, and then we're going to worship Him together.